does a mother murder her own?
It's very hard to understand why someone would kill their children. They're not thinking clearly.
A house of horror is ruled by a monster.
She said, when mom's done with me, she's gonna kill you.
A high-flying mom turns on her family.
I think that in that moment, she did a monstrous thing.
And this killer is a collector.
I could see the eye and the nose and the mouth of a little baby.
These deadly women kill their own flesh and blood, breaking the sacred bond. Terry Walker is a survivor. A woman with a terrifying past.
To be honest, it was such a far-fetched story that they kind of thought I was making it all up.
But no imagination could conjure this shocking truth. Or the identity of the killer.
She was my mom. My mom.
Twenty-year-old Susan Knorr always enters the family home with trepidation.
So you decided to come back, have you? Huh? And just look at you.
Her younger sisters, Sheila and Terry, are on edge, too.
Look at this piece of crap! Shut up!
My mom's personality was Jekyll and Hyde. One minute she could be the most loving person in the world, the next minute, you were scared you were gonna die.
You see that? And you're gonna grow up and look like her, are you?
Her sense of discipline and abuse were so far out of whack that it's just unbelievable.
For years, Teresa Knorr has been abusing her three daughters. Mentally and physically.
She's burned my back with cigarettes. She's put guns to my head. She's held knives to my throat, handcuffed me and beat me.
Hold her, buddy.
Teresa spares her two sons. They're encouraged to help the torment.
She liked men, but she didn't like women at all. She was jealous of her daughters. She enjoyed controlling them, controlling the house.
There was nothing in her mind but hatred, just sheer rage.
And today, that rage escalates to a place it's never been before.
My brother Robert was standing behind Susan, holding her back. My sister was fighting to get away. And my mom pulled the gun out and shot her.
What could drive a mother to shoot her daughter?
She was delusional and paranoid. And people that are delusional and paranoid should not be raising children. They are dangerous.
Teresa's terrifying delusions are symptoms of a mental illness. She's schizophrenic.
Schizophrenia is a mental illness that is believed to be some kind of genetic defect, chemical imbalance. People that get treatment can see symptom relief from the delusions. But Teresa wasn't getting treatment. And it grew, and it festered, and it became worse.
She believes her daughter's youth and their beauty are destroying her.
She thought her daughter, Susan, had cast a spell on her, and that spell was making her gain weight.
I said, getting that back.
Teresa thinks a bullet will stop the spell.
Teresa felt that Susan was the devil. She would try and tell the other children that she could see horns coming out of Susan's forehead.
Susan isn't dead. She's seriously wounded with the bullet lodged in her back. Her mother decides to let her live. But no one calls a doctor.
They were afraid of her. They were brought up under her violence. They weren't going to go to the authorities.
In the Knorr family, a trip to the hospital is out of the question. Susan is left to recuperate in the bath for 2 weeks.
The siblings are, part of them is thinking, well, better her than me. They grow up with this. They really don't understand that this isn't how life is in every household.
Incredibly, Susan makes a full recovery. But she knows she must leave her abusive mother.
My sister Susan would literally beg my mother, you know, Mom, please just let me go, you know. I'll do whatever you ask, just let me go. And my mom told her that if she let her take the bullet out of her back, that she'd let her go.
The price of Susan's freedom will be home surgery by her mother's hands.
I can see the top.
She wanted to remove the bullet that was lodged in her back because she didn't want, at some time in the future, for this bullet to be discovered and for law enforcement to come back and arrest her.
My mom hurt later on her stomach.
Here we go.
And she pulled the bullet out of my sister's back.
Why in the world Suzanne said okay to that is beyond me, but it does speak to the complete domination and control through fear that those children had of their mother. That promise of getting away was worth it.
Instead of gaining freedom, Susan becomes gravely ill, sliding into a coma as her body fights infection from the kitchen surgery. What comes next will be almost relief.
Taking her and her possessions, putting her on top of all of her possessions, pouring gas on her, lighting a match.
Her sons built a funeral pyre. Driven by schizophrenic delusions, she has already shot her daughter. Then cut the bullet out. Now, she wants to burn her body.
My mother thought that my sister had actually died when she pulled the bullet out of her, and that her body had been possessed by some evil spirit or a demon. In order for her to purge that evil spirit out of my sister's body had to be burned. All of her possessions in her had to be burned in order to free her soul.
Susan isn't dead. She's in a coma. Her mother is burning her alive. and gone, Teresa turns to her next eldest daughter, Sheila.
She would force feed her. Then if my sister wouldn't eat it all and would get so sick from being force fed, my mother would make her eat that food with the vomit in it.
Crazed by violent delusions, Teresa thinks her daughters are making her ugly.
Teresa's very existence as a woman was threatened by the presence of her daughters. She believed they were hurting her, that their youth, that their beauty was actually hurting Teresa.
Youngest daughter, Terry, is forced to witness each brutal act. In the height of summer, Teresa locks Sheila in a closet without food or water for over a week.
I'm gonna climb up and get to the light.
She kept saying she was crawling towards the light. She was gonna crawl towards the light.
Drink.
My mother left the house. I don't know exactly how long she was gone. It wasn't very long at all. And she left me there. And I tried to get my sister a beer. And my sister had explained to me she didn't want that. She wanted some water. Before I could get back to her with the water, my mother was pulling up. So I had to leave her there.
Beaten and bound, Sheila dies at just 20. Before she passes, she warns her little sister.
She told me, you know, Mom killed Susan. And Susan told me I would be next, and I am. And she said, and when Mom's done with me, she's gonna kill you.
Terry finally decides to leave. She runs to authorities, but her story is so grotesque, no one believes her.
I had told police officials, I had told a lawyer who went to the police in Sacramento, nobody believed me. So I was starting to doubt myself even.
In time, someone began putting the pieces together. Detective John Fitzgerald has two unsolved murder cases that seemed to confirm Terry's story.
One involved a young lady that was located along the highway. She was on fire at the time.
We're gonna put your sister in this box.
The other case involved a young lady that approximately 1 year later was discovered about 5 miles away at the edge of a small lake, and she had been placed in a box.
John Fitzgerald is my personal hero. He is the detective that kept the case open. He's the detective that ultimately came to my house and listened to me.
Terry told me that the two ladies who were killed in our area were her older sisters. She told me her mother was responsible for these two killings. In my mind and in my heart, I felt this was very valid information. She was telling me some things about these two crimes that nobody would know unless they were had some very close connections to them.
Terry's testimony and Detective Fitzgerald's tenacity end Teresa Knorr's reign of terror.
We obtained arrest warrants for the mother, Teresa, and for the two sons, William and Robert.
Son, Robert, is given 3 years jail. William Knorr is placed on probation. Teresa pleads guilty to both murders. Her mental state doesn't alleviate her punishment. She's currently serving consecutive life sentences.
Did Teresa love her children? At times, she probably did. But far more powerful than any love she might have ever felt for her daughters was the delusion that developed that her daughters were a threat to her.
Terry Knorr serves her own life sentence. Still affected by the horrors of her childhood and torn by the love that every daughter feels for their mother.
There's nothing she could ever tell me that would ever make me understand why she did what she did. But forgive her? Oh, yeah, I forgive her. And I do love her. I always have. She's my mother. That's it.
Parents are society's protectors.
Kate!
Children depend on it. For their lives. But some women break
jump.
The parents' code.
Kate, jump!
I can't do it, I'm afraid!
Like Deborah Green, one night in Kansas City.
You jump now!
The victims were children who were innocent and dependent on her to take care of them. She betrayed them.
To the world in the early 1990s. This is a successful family. Dr. Mike Farah is a promising cardiologist. Kids Kelly, Tim, and Kate are happy and confident. Their mom's a doctor too. Oncologist Deborah Green. But beneath the surface lies danger.
I think most people would look at her and see Deborah Green as a successful oncologist, but she was perhaps tortured with issues involving alcohol abuse, mental illness issues, and emotional maturity issues.
Deborah has been a straight A achiever all her life. But medicine demands more than just smarts.
No, 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 this is not right.
Deborah Green's biggest problem was Deborah Green.
Deborah suffers severe mood swings, lashing out at colleagues and patients.
I do it all over again.
And when the lows hit, she turns to alcohol and narcotics to stop the pain.
She wasn't cut out for dealing with patients. I mean, she was, you know, very smart and technically maybe a good doctor, but her bedside manner was lacking.
Journalist Tony Rizzo investigated Deborah's fall. From valued doctor to ostracized clinician.
She quit actively practicing medicine. She did some work like that involved, you know, reviewing records and things like that, but she wasn't really involved with dealing with patients.
The moods and the tantrums shut Deborah off from colleagues and family.
She rose to a pinnacle very early in life, but her personality didn't keep up with it. Her self-discipline didn't keep up with it. Her self-control was never there, and it started to fall apart.
What are you doing on this place? The pink spot.
Oh, God. Husband Mike finds her drunk once too often.
I've done that.
He threatens to leave and starts an affair. Everything Deborah has is slipping through her fingers. Her career, her prestige, her husband. So she starts planning retribution with a deadly poison.
She used ricin, which she obtained from seeds of the castor plant, which is an ornamental plant. And it was apparently crushed up and put into the food that she served him.
You want some?
Yeah, I would, thanks. But what's our soup?
Chicken.
Ricin is probably one of the top one, two, or three most toxic substances that are naturally derived on Earth. There's so much pain and suffering associated with ricin poisoning. This is a death that punishes.
Within hours, Mike Farah's body will react violently.
The toxin attacks all the cells that line the gastrointestinal tract, the esophagus, the stomach, the small and large bowel, if it makes it that far. The person becomes rapidly dehydrated, they have terrible abdominal pain, and then rather rapidly their blood pressure will drop, their heart rate will increase, and unless they get supportive medical care, they're going to die.
But Mike is not the only person on Deborah's hit list.
I can't imagine how frightening, terrifying, few moments that was for the children.
Dr. Deborah Green is having a breakdown. She has a history of depression. Her husband Mike can't control her.
Mike had taken Deborah to the hospital in an attempt to have her mentally committed.
Mike has found poisonous castor beans in their home and thinks she's trying to kill herself.
The doctor examined her and determined that it was a family dispute and was not something that would be a mental commitment situation.
Mike doesn't realize the deadly poison was meant for him. It's the reason he's been so sick lately. Wasn't enough to kill him. But his wife hasn't finished yet.
When Michael tried to commit Deborah Green at the hospital, she made a statement to him that you will get the children over our dead bodies.
Exasperated by his wife's behavior, Mike moves out of the family home. The arguments continue.
At about 11:30 p.m., Deborah and her husband had a heated argument over Deborah's drinking and issues with caring for the children.
Mike threatens to take the children, and Deborah snaps.
Deborah's need to punish Mike superseded any love she might have ever felt, if she ever did, for her own three children. The best way to hurt Mike was to kill the kids.
The events of that night were sort of a perfect storm of three different factors. She obviously had some mental health issues. that had not been addressed. When you put on top of that the heavy consumption of alcohol, and then the angry relationship, I think that in that moment, she did a monstrous thing.
She set the house on fire.
Upstairs, Tim, Kate, and Kelly are soon woken by flames.
Her son, Tim, got on the intercom and asked what he should do during this fire. And Deborah Green told her son to remain in his room and wait for the professionals to arrive.
I can't imagine how frightening, terrifying, you know, few moments that was for the children.
Kate heads straight for the window.
Kate!
And makes her way onto the roof. She has a simple choice. Jump or perish.
Kate, jump!
I can't do it, I'm afraid!
You jump now!
Deborah Green stepped aside and the daughter landed on the ground.
Help!
It's very hard to understand why someone would kill their children, but you have to remember that the women that would think that murder's the only answer aren't thinking right to begin with.
It's a two-story building. It's almost completely in flames now. We need you guys
police
here now.
Police arrive,
we need
to get... along with Mike.
What's going on?
Who is that?
But it's too late.
I've got to get the children. Please. I've got to get my kids.
Lying dead in their bedrooms, where Mom told them to wait, are 13-year-old Tim and 6-year-old Kelly.
One of the most gut-wrenching scenes was seeing the picture of the little girl, the 6-year-old. When they found her body, she was basically curled up on her bed in kind of a fetal position, but, you know, looked like she was sleeping.
I could not begin to imagine how her husband would feel after having lost two of his children to what she did.
A lot of people were affected by this case. It's just so shocking to have a situation where you have a mother that's capable of doing something like this to her own children.
The fire investigators found about 4 different points of origin of the fire. They determined that an accelerant was used and that the fire was intentionally set, that it was arson.
Deborah is the prime suspect. She's charged with murdering her children. Attempted murder of her husband. Aggravated arson. Found guilty on all counts. She's sentenced to 40 years.
If Deborah ever did love her children, by the time she killed them, all of those feelings had long since died. The only thing that mattered in Deborah's life was making Mike pay for leaving her.
She did a monstrous thing, but I don't think that necessarily means that she was a monster. But in this case, it was hard to not feel some anger towards her. And the victims were children who were innocent and dependent on her to take care of them. And she betrayed them.
Murder can be found in the most surprising places.
There was an orb there about the size of a softball, and it was grayish, leatherish looking.
A horrifying secret.
And I said to myself, oh, I hope this isn't what I think it is.
Is preserved in storage.
I could see the eye and the nose and the mouth of a little baby.
She was using murder as a form of abortion.
In the early 1970s, at Conewango Lake, upstate New York, Diane O'Dell is a young woman giving in to her desires.
The way Diane was, it was like, now I can do whatever I want because I'm free. And she did. She met the wrong guys, and she got pregnant, and all kinds of bad things happened.
Diane is a headstrong go-getter who won't listen to her mother, Mabel.
Mabel had no control over her. So if Diane wanted to go out at 2 o'clock in the morning and meet some guy and go for a trice in the woods, that's what she did.
Diane's wild ways soon deliver consequences. A teenage pregnancy with a terrible aftermath.
I think that Diane O'Dell did not want this baby. And when this baby came out, she was alone and she murdered this baby.
It's easier to kill a newborn baby for some women because the bond, the mother-child bond, hasn't been formed. For most women, though, that bond starts forming the moment she finds out she's pregnant. That did not happen with Diane.
Diane makes another shocking decision. She doesn't dispose of the body. She keeps it in a blue suitcase. Author M. William Phelps has interviewed Diane O'Dell, asking her why.
Well, one of the reasons she gives me is that she wanted to give the baby a proper burial at some point in its life. And she didn't just want to discard the baby as if it was a piece of garbage.
The nameless infant will never be buried.
What?
For the next 15 years, Diane takes the corpse wherever she goes. As Diane and her mother move around the country, she dreams of finding the ideal husband and father.
She wanted a man to go out and work during the day while she stayed home with the kids. She lived in that fantasy world of the 1950s and 60s.
For 5 short years, she finds that dream. Marriage to James O'Dell and 3 healthy children. But when the marriage ends, she returns to her wild ways.
So, Diane is again without a man in her life. She's got 3 living kids and 1 baby in a suitcase. And she gets pregnant by, she doesn't really know who. She's sleeping with so many different men at the same time.
Her 5th pregnancy is a problem. With no husband, another child is another burden. But Diane has a solution.
There probably wasn't much decision-making going on in her head to kill that child. It was easy. She'd done it before, and the child wasn't doing her any good.
Diane O'Dell is is becoming a serial killer of her own children.
Diane's mind was twisted.
Diane O'Dell has her own solution to unwanted pregnancies. Murder.
Smothering an infant is very easy. They can die without much effort at all.
With most infants, if something is placed over their mouth or nose, is their exhaled carbon dioxide is then re-inhaled in. And subsequently, with the child becomes hypercarbic, which is increased carbon dioxide. Death ensues shortly thereafter.
Maybe she did it for guilt. Maybe she did it because she was afraid to leave them behind, thinking they'd be found and she'd get in trouble. Maybe she did it because she could convince herself if she had them, they weren't really dead. We really don't know. Diane's mind was twisted.
Diane's preserved victims have one thing in common. Their fathers weren't around before they were born.
Whenever there's a paycheck around, she kept the baby because the baby could then, what? Provide her with money. The dad was bringing the money into the house.
There will be more pregnancies, more boxes. Eventually, Diane has four dead babies.
Basically, for Diane O'Dell, whenever she got pregnant and the father of the child wasn't around, she murdered that child. She was using murder as a form of abortion.
The murders only stop when Diane settles down with a new man and has four healthy children. But nearly 20 years later, her dark past will resurface. Diane has abandoned her personal possessions in an Arizona storage facility. When she doesn't pay the rent, the contents are sold. Thomas Bright thinks he's got a bargain.
I got a whiff of a musty smell out of it, you know, and there was some brown, flaky material, too.
But he's bought himself a crime scene.
I said to myself, oh, I hope this isn't what I think it is. And I pushed the bag a little further apart, and I could see the eye and the nose and the mouth of a little baby.
In the police.
Yeah, I thought I'd pick up some.
Not only do they find one baby, as they start digging through the boxes, there's another one. Two babies. They start digging through more boxes, three babies.
Along with the bodies are documents and effects leading straight to Diane O'Dell. Detective Thomas Scalepi calls in Diane O'Dell for an extraordinary interview.
She was very articulate. She was almost like a grandmotherly type. I mean, she's an older woman, middle-aged.
Diane says the babies were all stillborn, and she couldn't afford a proper burial.
The odds of that, four babies being stillborn, and eight healthy children that we knew she had, were, to me, was minuscule. If there was some type of foul play, I wanted to get to the bottom of it. If the babies were stillborn, we had absolutely no charges. We had no charges against her at all. If the babies were born alive, naturally we had murder.
After more than 20 years, Diane is their only lead. Forensic testing of the remains can't distinguish misfortune from murder.
It is a determination that is extremely difficult to make, and a determination made years and years later on mummified remains would be virtually impossible.
But Diane will make the key admission.
How did you feel about that? The baby cried.
That's when she told us that, yes, the baby did gasp and cry. She eventually told us that all three babies gasped or cried.
The babies cried. When they were born, they were alive.
The only way they can build a case against her is if Diane O'Dell puts a noose around her own neck, which she just did.
She asked me, what do you think is going to happen to me? I said, Diane, what do you think should happen to you? And that's when she just looked at me and she says, I think I should go to jail.
Diane O'Dell is found guilty of three murders. She's serving the sentences concurrently over 25 years.
I think there was more to it than simply killing them because they were illegitimate. Most mothers love their child no matter what the circumstances of their birth are. Diane did not.
I was stunned. If you didn't want the child, give it up. There's agencies that could take the children. You don't have to kill them.
Even Diane's brother, Richard, finds it hard to forgive her.
I have no remorse over where she is. I was probably one of the first to applaud when I heard the verdict. She didn't deserve any mercy. Not for what she did.
There's nothing like a mother's love from these deadly women. Driven by delusions, Teresa Knorr destroyed her daughters. Deborah Green slayed her children for warped revenge. And Diane O'Dell callously snuffed out brand new lives. They murdered the very children they gave life to, breaking the sacred bond between mother and child.